There is a difference between curing and healing. The church, according to Rachel Held Evans, is called to the slow and difficult work of healing. We are called to enter into one another's pain, anoint it as holy, and stick around no matter what the outcome. I think it was quite a few years ago that I started to feel the tension of my family was getting bigger. The church we were attending was getting much larger. And see, any group I'm in, whether it's a church or a neighborhood or a swim team or cheer squad, I love to connect. I love to connect with others. I love to help the other people connect with each other. And I just love doing that. I mean, as long as I can remember, I have craved connection and craved facilitating connection. So this was a role I took on just truly, just organically, voluntarily, in the space I was in the church community that I was in. And it, you know, it was difficult because every few years at the church I was at, people would leave, and they're oftentimes they would cite the reason they were leaving because it was a highly transitory community. The reason they would leave was because there was a lack of community. And so I couldn't fix that. That was not mine to do, but I did really feel so strongly about where I was at, where I was planted, to do my part in helping to connect people. And so for better or worse, that's what I did. You know, sometimes far too much in my ego, and sometimes out of pure love, and probably a lot of times some sort of combination and mix of the two. But really, there got to a point where I became so disillusioned and so discouraged about how low of a priority connection and community was. See, I was still craving for far more that was offered, and the places that it was offered were getting cut out of the budget. And this was a blow. This was a crushing blow to me because this was my personality, but became a war in my head and my heart. Because like the inner critic in my head was, Julie, it's not about you. It's about the lost and the least. It's not about what you need. But my heart was like, oh, how I crave these spaces. And oh, how I deeply sense that others crave them too. So it became a war of like, am I being too selfish? Or wait, this is what we all need. So you can only imagine, once you hear the interview today with Michael Hendricks, one of the authors from the other half of church, when I learned that it's actual brain science that shows our deep need for face-to-face connection and community, and that is like the whole other side of church that we are completely missing. And just like a baby's brain grows on joy, our lives grow in connection. I went to town. I became ravenous for years, studying about community and what it does to our physical health and our mental health. And I mean, it just became a gigantic rabbit trail. And now I'm bringing you all along on a slice of that rabbit trail because this book was so healing and so transformative for like a bigger vision of what communities that I, going forward for the second half of my life, wanted to be a part of. I wanted to be a part of full-brained communities that really recognized the other half of church. So enjoy.
Welcome.
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 To celebrate.
To celebrate.
Holly.
Welcome to celebrate story.
With my mom.
My mom.
With my mom.
With my mom.
With my wife.
Julie Wagner.
Julie Wagner.
Julie Wagner.
Julie Wagner.
Welcome to Celebrate Story. I'm so glad you're here. I am so thankful to be able to have the next half hour to hour time to explore the topics from the other half of church. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Julie. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I am a brand new podcaster. I started a podcast in the fall, exploring storytelling. And I have a quote in your book that connects so much to what your book is about, and what my podcast is about. So I thought I'd start there.
Yes.
It's top of page 191, it says, connecting all our emotions to joy is done primarily by storytelling, not by teaching. Mm-hmm. I love that so much. As a homeschool mom of eight, I try to do so much through just the fruit of storytelling with my children. And the podcast was birthed out of a place of just wanting to share stories of things I loved that I read that brought healing or hope. And that's what this book has been for me. I went through a period of being, after 15 some years of being on staff and a volunteer in a church, disillusioned and disappointed and discouraged. And I was so thankful for the message of that it matters that we're in relationship and the way joy was defined by neuroscience. So could you start off by, like, I'd love to hear you put it in your words, the definition of joy according to neuroscience and why it matters in the church.
Yeah, it's also so important because, I mean, you know, as followers of Jesus, we believe the author of Scripture and the designer of our brain are the one and same person, right? And so we should actually expect neuroscience to agree with what we read in the Bible. And specifically what has been found from some researchers, mainly one, Dr. Alan Shore from UCLA. It used to be that people thought the brain was mainly designed around fear. And he's the one through his research said, no, actually the brain is designed looking for one thing more than any other thing. And that thing is joy. And joy he defined as the sparkle in your eye that tells me that you know, you're happy to be with me. So when I see you, in another way, it's your face lighting up. It's largely nonverbal, words aren't necessary, but when your eyes sparkle, your face lights up, and I can tell that I feel joy because I feel it's a feeling of being special, of being wanted, and being happy to be together.
That's so, so powerful. And something that sticks out from what you just said from the book is this idea that brain science shows that, and correct me here because you're the expert here. The first 3 years of life that a child's brain grows on the experience of joy. And being a mom of 8 children, you know, this connected so deeply. And being a ministry worker, I often had such pain of there was so many more people that wanted to connect and there was time to connect in like a massive big setting situation. And so it made intuitive sense to me, because I knew that the times I was most connected in joy relationships, I was just very effortlessly growing. I'd love to hear a little bit more about so I think one of the chapters that really sticks out to me is you talking about this idea, because it's so foreign to what I've experienced. And I want to just move into that direction of this Hesed type of community. What do you think about the fact that, you know, so many spaces in Charlotte are kind of the culture of Charlotte in general is very transient. You know, most of us have moved here from another state. My husband and I moved here 17 years ago from Maryland. And so it is very transitory. Yep. And so that by nature affects the churches that we go to, that people are in and out. But I think also what affects it in some cultures is that our commitment to, you know, it's not about you, it's about the lost and the least at all costs. And I believed that for a long time because you don't want to be a bad Christian that doesn't care about lost people, right? But I was so feeling some healing with this idea that you really talked about, that the ministry can't trump the relationships. And that just summarized, I would love to hear you talk more about that, because that seems to make so much gut level sense.
Yeah. You know, when you look at how we were designed to transform and to learn to love like Jesus loves, that's, you know, really the ultimate goal of discipleship is to learn how to love people just like Jesus loves. Right. Well, and we've done a pretty good job telling people that they should do that, right, in churches. But what we haven't done very well is teaching people how. And so how, it requires a couple different things. It requires, first of all, some actual practice and repetition, very much like, you know, if you're learning to play the guitar or the piano the first time, you have to do these really boring things over and over again to develop really good habits, and all of a sudden it's just natural. So there's a certain aspect of learning how to love like Jesus loves that we just have to do some really good practices over and over again. A lot of us, for what we do, the practices are building joy, like you just talked about. Like, you know, we were born, Ava, as babies, as you mentioned earlier. A baby's brain is largely unformed when they're born. There's just parts in the right and in the brain stem, and then these interactions with mother with joy. You know, and you think about it, if you're nursing a baby and then a baby gets kind of full, stops nursing, looks up at mother, the baby's face lights up, the mother's face lights up, the baby's face lights up more, the mother's face, and it's called, you know, Jim Wilder used the term climbing joy mountain, like baby joy, mom joy, baby joy, mom joy, baby joy. But you get to a point where it's there's so much joy that it's uncomfortable for the baby. And so the baby then will break eye contact, because this is all eye contact. There's no words, you know, baby doesn't have words yet. A baby will break eye contact. And if a mother, you know, is wise and knows how to read the cues, the mother will let the baby break contact. The mother will break contact, will not continue to try to build joy. And the baby will rest. And that rest actually kind of just absorbs this beautiful joy and allows it to, you know, I'm using layman's language, you know, neuroscience would say other things. But in probably 30 seconds later, the baby's boom, back to mother, and they're up, they're climbing joy mountain. And a baby and mother do this hundreds and hundreds of times a day in the first, you know, 6 months of life. And it's those interactions that really start the whole ball rolling of a really healthy Hesed attachment, of being able to attach at a healthy level. And joy is really kind of like the fuel for everything else we do relationally and emotionally. Both as a baby and even as adults, you know, our churches were really designed to be very, very high joy places, communities, meaning that when we get together, our faces light up on each other, like we're excited to be each other. This doesn't mean that we're eternally happy, like we're a community that's always happy, because joy isn't happiness. Joy is happy to be togetherness. Mm. And so even in your darkest, deepest trial, if I show up, say I'm really suffering from a big loss and I show up to my community and their faces are lighting up on me, but it's not smiles in that case. That case is like the serious thought saying, we are with you on this. You are not alone. I don't know what to say, but I'm with you. And I'm just, you know, it's these interactions of I can tell they're happy to be with me in my sadness or my anger or my shame. Or whatever emotion it happens to be. So joy is really meant to be built into the relational network of all of our emotions are meant to be highly joyful, meaning we're really glad to be together in all of these emotions, including the really positive ones and victories and successes and great things and the deepest and hardest things of life.
So how do you get from, I know one of the things y'all mentioned in the book that the design, the very function of our church is the fact that we're in these rows. And I think you said that on the podcast too. Like we're in these rows that all face forward. They're set up in a low joy possibility format. Like how do we get, I mean, we can't just all of a sudden like just turn all of our chairs in giant circles. And how do we go from here? Like what, does that make sense? Cause it's like, that is the structure of church. And even I think about how so many churches are moving online. And it's like, and I'm curious what you think about this. So this would be like a secondary question. Do you think joy can be experienced online? Can joy, face-to-face joy, be experienced online? Or is it different? Or is it a different degree? I'm curious your thoughts on both of those things.
Well, these are really the questions we're asking, right? And we, you know, I work with Jim Wilder and others at a place called Life Model Works, where we're tackling the theory behind all this, and we're trying things out. And we understand the neuroscience and the biblical support of that neuroscience. The question is, how does it best work in the average day church, from anywhere, you know, from an inner city church to a suburban church to a rural church to, you know, an Ethiopian church that meets underneath a mango tree, right? How do we bring in all that? I actually think that those questions will be solved by a learning, kind of interactive learning network of communities that just go out and try things. And then we help connect people and share what works, what doesn't work. Here's a story we have. Again, a lot of it's what you said. It's telling stories of, you know, we tried this and, you know, we tried moving the benches around and it did not work. People were just so uncomfortable. But we did this other thing and, you know, so some general rules there, you know, it's not like I don't have any answers for that question at all. It's just, I think it is eventually going to be answered by a people. There's not going to be a big personality leading the way. We believe it's going to be a learning community trying to figure this out together and openly sharing across all churches, denominations, and everything else, how we're building joy, how we're deepening our attachments to each other. But a few things we can do is one thing churches often do is they don't let people quiet themselves when they first get ready to worship. And so really joy, you know, I talked about Joy Mountain, you know, when the baby breaks contact, that's called the quiet circle. So there's the joy and a quiet circle that our brain was designed to really be as a foundation for healthy attachments. And, you know, if we never build and churches are the same way. Churches have to be very joyful, and they also have to be places where you can be quiet together. And I'll be looking to connect with you when I sense you need to connect. Although sometimes people don't want to connect. They need some space, right? And if I charge through with joy, joy is a good thing, right? But if I charge at you with joy at that point, it's actually harming our detachment. It's harming our hesed. Mm. Which is the Hebrew word that closest comes to the attachment we see in neuroscience. So really a healthy attachment is a combination of reading the signals of when someone wants to connect and build joy and when someone needs some rest and some space. Okay?
Oh, so beautiful.
So a lot of people come to church. You know, one person comes to church and it was a great morning. Everything's fine. The kids took their baths and nobody fought and we drive to church and we show up and everything's good. And you know, on another Sunday, you know, I fight with my wife. My kids are fighting with each other. They spill something, paint on the carpet just as we're leaving and blah, blah, blah. We show up to church and all of a sudden we're blasted with some praise music or whatever. And it'd be, you know, this is big time where I actually need some quieting space. And just having a minute, all it takes is a minute. We're not talking sit for an hour and quiet. But have someone who understands that and says, okay, you know, we're coming from all kinds of backgrounds. God is in this room. Many of us can't feel him right now. You know, if your baby threw up all over the car on the drive to church, you may not be feeling God's presence right now. He's here, but we just can't feel it. Let's quiet together and just sit in God's presence for a moment. So that's something you can do. That really prepares your heart to slow down and turn off. You know, we can get stuck in either big emotions or we can get stuck in just kind of the hamster wheel of thoughts. And that creates so much background noise that it's hard for us to sense God in it.
Mm. And it's so, I can't help when I think about my pursuit of silence personally, I think of my greatest obstacle is continually reevaluating my relationship with technology. Mm-hmm. And teaching and guiding and the weight of, you know, my kids are watching every second of how I use technology and are mimicking exactly how I use technology. And so that kind of circles back to, it's like with us all having more of a challenge for silence from our phones, because we have so much information, is I guess I'm still questioning, like, how do we make these hesed joyful spaces? Like, is that possible? Because in my own life, personally, I use the two most used apps I use on my phone are Marco Polo and Voxer, because as a homeschool mom of eight, well, seven now, one's off at college, it's like to be able to get these doses of joy, like to go for a run and Marco Polo two friends about books we're reading. Great. That gives me a dose of joy to be able to then be present and give that joy to my children. And then I think about in the afternoon, it's like sitting down, drinking a cup of coffee, getting a dose of joy by Voxer. But then I think about like the end of, is it 2 John and 3 John? I love those words. It's like, I have so much more I want to say to you, but it will be, my joy will be complete when I see you in person. And so I'm wrestling with like, how much do I use technology and like robbing myself possibly of the fullness of joy? And how much do I need to grow in like less technology joyful connections or can they even, have they done any studies on like, is it still joy if it's like technological connections?
Yeah, you can't technically climb Joy Mountain with a person over video because it's a between my brain and your brain, it's a 6 times a second kind of feedback loop. So our eyes are actually doing things 6 times a second. That's building joy, and the video lag is too long. So that that's part of the reason why we often get really tired when we're on like a Zoom call or some sort of video call is because our brains are trying to establish this right eye to right eye joy building link, but it's impossible because we don't have, you know, it's not fast enough.
Wow.
Now we can build some joy online because if you and I already have a relationship and have spent time in person, and then if we're connecting online, our brains can kind of fill in the gaps just using memories. So if there's already somewhat of an attachment there, we can get a measure of joy. Like it's kind of like John said, he's not saying you don't get any joy from my letters, but when I'm with you in person, face to face, that's the fullness of joy, right? And so we get some joy. The real key is to know that even are our apps and our phones robbing us of the face-to-face joy, or are they just supplementing and under control? So it can be used for good and for bad. And to realize, you know, no matter how much we connect with our friends and things over apps and over social media for technology, there's still a great, great importance to be face-to-face.
Oh. So do you think, because I can't help but think of like my introverted friends, do you think that, because if I'm understanding this right, our brains grow on joy. And as an extrovert, I'm like, yes, I knew that. I knew the more I'm with people that are present with me and I'm present with them, there's something mysterious about what happens. But then I think of my introverted friends that drains them. I'm curious if what you would say about that.
Yeah, the draining can be that they need larger doses of quiet and smaller doses of joy, but they still need joy. They will not survive without joy. And so the key then is that we learn to read the cues, and they're nonverbal cues. Okay. There's things, and we even do drills when we're together where we will intentionally overwhelm someone. We'll actually walk towards someone with our hand like this and have a whole group watching your face as I'm walking towards you. And all of a sudden someone will say, yep, I just saw it. Her left eye just twitched. Or there was a tenseness in her jaw, or all these. And so we're trying to train our brains to catch these nonverbal cues that are telling us, give Julie a break. You're overwhelming her. Give her a rest, right? If we don't learn to read those cues, then we're just constantly overwhelming each other. And so, you know, handling someone who needs a little more rest and a little less joy is very, very trust building. Like when a very introverted person, you know, connects with someone and then they give them space when they see it, all of a sudden there's a trust there that maybe they don't experience with a lot of people because usually they just get overwhelmed by joy.
Oh, that is so, and it seems like it's a foreign language to us as we have become more isolated, necessarily so. I'm so curious. I'd love to jump. There's so much. I mean, there's so many different directions. My brain is on fire. There's so many things I want to ask, but I want to skip to understanding. Okay, so y'all blew my mind on the shame chapter because I've read a lot by Brené Brown. And so really understanding these ideas. And I think the biggest things I learned from that was that we connect with others through our weaknesses, not our strengths, which is very much what y'all were talking about. But this idea of good shame versus bad shame, like I really had to chew on that.
Yeah.
And what was hardest for me to take in from your book was actually the most healing, ironically. So could you, for our listeners, like talk about the difference between healthy shame and unhealthy shame? I'd love to hear you kind of summarize those ideas.
Yeah, for most of us, all shame is toxic because we've never really experienced the healthy shame, right? Amen. So that's why there's such a resistance to that. Me too. And unhealthy shame is just some form of the message, you are bad. And so it's basically telling what's wrong with you, what I don't like about you, and then I just leave, then I slam the door and leave, right? It's not relational, and it's not, I'm not showing you any way to recover from that. Healthy joy, on the other hand, is just, I mean, healthy shame is the opposite of joy, which is essentially, you know, I feel shame when I can tell from your face and your eyes, just like with joy, that you're not happy to be with me. So let's say you and I are on staff in a church and I'm running a meeting and some woman offers an idea and I kind of shut her down in all my verbals of saying, what a stupid idea, you're wasting my time, right? And then the meeting's over and I go back to my office and you saw the whole thing. You weren't part of it. And you said, that didn't feel right. And so you come to my office door, knock on the door and say, hey, Michael, you know, back in that meeting when Susan offered that one idea and it seemed to me you discounted, dismissed it and almost kind of scoffed at it. And I think you might have forgotten who we are. Let me remind you who we are. We are a people who are very, very patient with others because God has always been so patient with us. And I don't think I saw your best self back there. Now, the difference between that and toxic shame is that you knocked on my door, you looked me in the eyes, you affirmed even our attachment, and then, you know, you basically said, I think you forgot who we are. So it really relies on this thing called group identity. Ugh. We're pulling from group identity of what kind of people are we as citizens of God's kingdom? Well, we're a patient people, right? Yes. Very, you know, foundational level. We are very, very patient because God is very patient. You know, James says we're supposed to be very, very fast to listen, but slow to speak, right? Slow to become angry. And that probably applies to slow to become annoyed by an idea I thought was dumb, right? Mm. And I had probably grown up in my house and seen the same thing in my parents and in my siblings and stuff. And all of a sudden, Julie shows up at my door. If we have a Hesed attachment, you have access to my character. And you're actually, by correcting me in a healthy way, you're rewiring my brain. Mm. You're actually rewiring my future spontaneous responses to similar situations. So a year from then, I may be leading a meeting and someone offers a truly dumb idea. And my spontaneous reaction to that is patience and kindness and respect. Mm. And you know when you start doing this character work, you'll have those kind of spontaneous changes in character, and then you'll come away and I'll go, wow, you know, 2 years ago I would have not have responded that way. And a lot of the thanks would have been to you because you actually had the courage and the attachment and the wisdom to come and remind me who I really was when I had forgotten.
Oh. And that's those sections, you gave actual kind of script samples to kind of role play. And I have been formed by those words with my kids. I mean, I use that with my children of, you know, we have been made in love, for love, to love. And this was not in the direction of love. This is not the way we want to move. We want to move this way. And it's so powerful. And it also is so convicting, because it makes me realize where I was involved and perpetuated a toxic culture, a culture of, I'm struggling still on how to label it, but I think when there's a power dynamic of where leaders can convict down and maybe like red flag or, oh, we're going to take it, you know, oh, this person's dangerous. Kind of, and I can only steal from others' words because I haven't found mine yet, but Marshall Rosenberg, who wrote Nonviolent Communication, he talks about in a principle of to observe without evaluating. And so I'm coming out of a culture where there was a lot of evaluating, you know, there'd be a love bomb of you're great. And there'd also be toxic, shamey message. And so I'm really trying to unpack and heal. And really, that's what this book and this podcast is for. I'm a wounded healer, and I want to confess where I have unfairly labeled and unfairly passed on that shame and those labels. And how can I like go the other direction? And so I'm curious just for you to unpack a little bit more about the enemy section, in the narcissistic chapter of like, when there's like this innocence, this like enemy shame, I'm not using the right word. Let me turn to my bookmark. But if you know exactly where you want to go with that, please do jump in, because I'd love to hear you talk more about that, because it's such a foreign world, because I've experienced so much and done so much toxic shame.
Yeah, you know, our brains, you know, we're basically given God two brains that work together, our right brain and our left brain, and they're meant to work really well coupled together. And our left brain is kind of what we normally think in culture as our brain, which is our thoughts and our strategies and words and problem solving, willpower, all that kind of stuff. And I'm being general, you know, I'm generalized. This is just the control processor of the brain. And the control processor on the right brain is largely relational, meaning it deals with, you know, joy. Who's happy to be with me? Is this a safe environment? When people attune to me and I'm attuning to people, this is really a right brain dominant function. And who am I? What kind of people are we? How do we act as our people? That doesn't mean, you know, it's all right brain, because there's tendrils into both sides. The brain's very complex, so it's not all left and all right. But that's kind of the dominance is what we're talking about. And when our right brain, the relational control process, is up and running well, we see everything in life through a very relational lens. And it very much aligns with what Paul writes to the Colossians in chapter 3 when he says, you know, since we're dearly beloved by God, we clothe ourselves with compassion and kindness and humility and gentleness and patience. And Paul doesn't say those are things we strive to do. He says we actually clothe ourselves with them. They're part of who we are. It's what people see when they see us. It's our identity. You know, I think that's a good verse to put to memory. That's really a verse that's saying your relational part of your brain is up and it's running. Well, sometimes when we're in distress, we're in big emotions, and get stuck in those emotions, our right brain, these kind of circuits, relational circuits we have, they go down. They kind of like a circuit breaker, they start going off. And that's when we go, what you were talking about, in what we call enemy mode, where we start to see when those circuits are not working properly. Instead of the Colossians 3 of compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, we tend to see other people as either, annoyances to be avoided, or we see people as problems to be solved, or we see them as enemies to be conquered, to be defeated. But in any of those cases, we're not acting with compassion, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, right? So some of the things we do in a, I work with churches and consult with churches, and some of the training we do is I explain the concepts to them, and then usually we meet twice a month for 90 minutes, you know, for over a year, and I'll send them off for 2 weeks and say, okay, for the next 2 weeks, write down any time you suspect your brain has kind of switched its relational circuits off and you're starting to treat people like enemies or annoyances or people to be avoided or things like that. And then let's come back and, as you said earlier, share stories. Like, oh, I was driving and this guy cut me off and I said some things which I thought, wow, my brain just went off. And then another person, well, yeah, my husband, he forgot to do this, and I just act, you know, and then it's just like this ping pong of stories of when our brain kind of went into this enemy mode.
Oh.
And then we tell stories of what was your experience trying to get your relational circuits back on quickly? And so this is kind of the training we do, and without noticing these kinds of things and learning how to recover from enemy mode, we'll never love people like Jesus loves on a consistent basis. We'll only love people well when things are going pretty smooth. But when there's any big waves, boom, we're not loving each other anymore.
Mm, that is so good. I'm so glad I'm recording this so I can rewind it, hear it, and figure out how to do that exercise in my family, because I see myself in that, and I see, oh, it breaks my heart how I see, when people leave. And I know this is not unique to just the cultures I've been in, because it's been in an educational environment I've been and in a church environment I've been, that when people leave, we tend to make them an enemy. It becomes an us versus them mentality. Mm-hmm. And or even the people in charge, it becomes the us versus them mentality. Because I think you talked about that. You had a list in here of like low Hesed environments.
Yes.
And that is, I have confessed that sin, and I'm really working on going in the other direction of like, and I'm so grateful to have learned that someone leaving doesn't make them an enemy of what we're doing here.
Right.
Like it's thinking so small of God's big work. And I'm so grateful to kind of be growing and moving in that direction. How do you recommend someone finding, like if someone's in an area, how do you see these things when you're searching for a community? Because it's, you know, I look at this list, like hindsight always is 2020, right? I look at this list in the chapter towards the end of the book, before the chapter right before A Full-Brained Christianity, yeah, of narcissism, the relational infection. And it was so helpful to see the list of, okay, this would be a low Hesed community. It's on page 166. And you talk about, you know, ideas like an us versus them mentality, or a harsh and abrupt, yes, firings of subordinates, firings with little explanation or communication, a church staff that sees its job as submissively implementing the leader's grand vision, a church staff environment where the leader is seldom given feedback or critique, but where the leader readily and openly criticizes, a leader who will turn another person from friend to exclude in an instant. It's like, oh, this is, yes, so powerful because I see this, but I only saw that after time. So, what advice do you have for someone looking for a place that they don't want to make the same mistake they made again? How do you see signs of a Hesed community and a joy-filled community and the other half of church, like a full-brained, yep, Christianity? What are some early, or maybe it's not that simple?
Well, that's one of the reasons we wrote that book, is to give people a picture. Give a lot of people a picture of what it looks like when we're not doing it, what it would look like when we are being deeply relational. You know, some things to look for is when you walk into the church, say you're visiting a church, if you walk in, do you see people's faces lighting up on other people? Maybe not on me, because they don't know me yet. They may not be there yet. Is it a church where people readily share weakness? Mm. Including the leaders, do they share their weaknesses, or are they hidden? Do the leaders seem to have remarkable relational skills and be able to handle big emotions in a way that's very relational? Mm. You know, a lot of things, these are hard to see, like just going once, but over time, that's what you're looking for. And do they actually have a plan for developing their people into disciples of Jesus who can love like Jesus loves? Like, do they talk about that a lot? Mm. And is love seen as the center of what we do, or is some mission statement seen as the center of what we do?
Love
is the center of the church. Everything else we do depends on love. And so if we're pushing a mission statement or a vision without founding it in love, we're going to do really good things with really bad character. Mm. Which is what we see the church doing over and over again.
Yes, and I think where I'm trying to turn away from and go a different direction is, it used to be about, and it's, you know, my area is that God's trusting me with these children. And so it's like, it used to be, and when my older three, who are all teenagers now, were little, it was so important to me to have this moment, like, when are they going to say the sinner's prayer and have this moment, right, of conversion? And I put so much energy into that. And now it's like my younger three are 3, 6, and 8. It's like, I have no interest in pushing that prayer. And I don't know if that's the right thing or the wrong thing, or just where it is in my walk within my spiritual journey. But to me, I no longer want to put emphasis on one moment of making the perfect words and the perfect choice, but that we're all just going to keep walking this long, slow, steady, crawling, crippling, limping walk in the direction of love. But I realize I learned that from growing up, the churches I grew up into. It was definitely about this moment of conversion, of I was lost and now I'm found. I have been baptized. And we count those things. And so, you know, and that's a collection of so many churches I was a part of. Like, that was my mentality. My mentality wasn't a discipleship mentality, a relational mentality. So it's a shift I'm trying to grow into. Yep. So.
Yeah. And you know, using group identity and kind of healthy shame in a way that you correct them in a healthy relational way, you know, all of those corrections are really directed towards helping your kids love better, to grow in maturity and love better. You know, even a three-year-old, you know, if they're throwing food on the floor, for example, or maybe that's a little younger when they do that.
Definitely over here.
You know, there's group identity. That's actually not being very loving. Mm. And so group identity is, you know, we don't create work for mommy and daddy, and we don't take this valuable food that God has provided for us. And I'm so thankful God is so faithful in providing food for us, but we don't take that food and then just throw it on the floor where we're wasting it and where mommy and daddy then have to go clean it up. I'd rather go play outside in the backyard on the swings with you than clean up spaghetti on the floor because you threw it. So that's not who we are. And you're getting really much more to the core, because I'm not saying that's not what we do, because usually we focus on the behavior. Stop doing that. Don't throw your food, or I'm going to send you to your room right now.
Yep, done that.
But that does not, I have to, but that does not give that child, first of all, it doesn't remind them who they are, and it doesn't give them a way out. Versus like me saying, I would much rather swing on the swing with you than cleaning up your spaghetti. That's not very nice to mommy and daddy either. And it's us not being nice to God, because he's provided this wonderful food for us because he loves us so much. Ugh. And, you know, if you gave me a gift and I threw it on the floor and stomped on it, would that make you happy? No, I think, you know, so, and that's very relational, because I'm interacting. I'm not blowing up and sending them to their room. We're interacting about what does it look like to love each other right now? Because I think you've forgotten.
And it's so helpful to hear that fleshed out, because I can see how I sometimes blend. The best labels I can think of are more like an authoritative approach of I'm right, yeah. You listen, this is happening, and a relational nurturant approach. And I can see how sometimes just by my own patterning, by my own upbringing, I think I'm moving in this nurturant relationship of like, and then it's like I'm still blending both. And it's such a process and such a journey of me receiving grace and then passing on that grace. It's such a journey, because it's so hard to get out of the programming of this is how it is. Because I think there's a culture of, I think there's shame for mothers if like you are having your child and out in public and they're doing something that they're not supposed to do. It's like, how are you going to correct it? Like there's such I don't know, such an opportunity for shame there.
Yeah. And the, you know, the conversion we want to make on that with these healthy corrections is, both when we have to correct our kids or someone else, or when they correct us, we want to get to the point where our instantaneous reaction is, oh boy, I get to correct my daughter's actual character to be more like Jesus today because she's losing it in the department store. Mm. And so we're actually excited because you have that attachment. You know, without Hesed, that attachment, you can't correct anybody's character. They'll dismiss it.
Yes.
Right. Our attachment, our Hesed, is like, it's like a firewall. It's like it's the door that needs to be opened. When we have Hesed, it opens the door to the character, building each other's character.
And how do you know when you have that outside of your family? Because it's like, I've almost out of fear been like, okay, only my family is that safe to have Hesed with. But that's not true. That's not healthy.
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, especially when moms... This is true with dads as well, but when moms finish the parenting job, in other words, when their youngest child is into the adult stage, like over 12 years old and kind of growing, most moms have a lot of mothering still in them. Mm. And they just kind of wait around for grandchildren. But there's a lot of people in their community that were never mothered properly and need some of that. And to most churches, that's kind of dangerous. No, we're not going to have a mother like... mothering this 27-year-old young man who had a really dysfunctional family and never saw good mothering. But that's about the only way that 27-year-old man is ever going to get fill in what wasn't given to him by his birth mother. Where if you start seeing that young man and, you know, and telling him who he is and being happy to be with that young man, but also telling him when he stops acting like himself, and helping that young man do hard things. That's another thing that, you know, the mothering stage around the child years, which is from 4 to 12, is teaching our children to do hard things. There's a lot of young men out there that never, ever learned how to do hard things. Mm. And mothers, there need to be mothers and fathers helping them. So there's all sorts of maturity stuff that's dependent on a more mature person in our life, right?
Yes, and time.
So these mothers that did a really good job, exactly, they've done a really good job with their kids. We don't want you mothering people when you still have kids in the house, you know, because you don't want to steal from your kids. But, you know, when your youngest is 12 years old, there starts to be open up a little bit and more a door for you to have some bandwidth for some other young women and young men who need what you have.
Mm.
And yes. So, but that involves, you know, building a bond with them. You know, you do it as a married couple, but you build a bond with them and fill in what they didn't get. And that's what we call a multi-generational community, which means, you know, we change in two ways. One way is telling stories of how we acted like ourselves and God's kingdom looked like and these big things and everything. But another one is them seeing it in real life. You know, so if you're inviting people over to your house and they're seeing how you and your husband are dealing with a hard thing with your teen, right? And that you're dealing with it relationally. And if they've never seen that before, I remember that happening to me, seeing someone handle an issue with their kid when their kid jammed a toy into a VCR machine and seeing him handle it really relationally. And I was like dumbfounded, right? And I credit that experience with helping me be a much less reactive father when I grew up, because my parents were largely reactive. And just me seeing that man handle that so well, it's almost like, you know, rewired my brain. And I was not a very reactive parent in most cases. I would have been much more, I should say. I was not perfect, but I would have been much more reactive had I not seen examples of a better way, of a more mature person doing it.
I have experienced that. And I think that's where I'm longing for an intergenerational community, because the communities I've been in, all of a sudden I realize we're mothering each other. We are mothering and fathering each other, because there is no space for the generations older than us. And like, what are we missing? Like, you don't know what you don't know. And I'm searching spaces to find that, because I need to know what I don't know.
Yeah. And a lot of times you don't need to be explained it. You need to actually see it.
Yes. Yes.
Because the part of our brain that builds this kind of character needs an image. It needs an example. It doesn't really respond to an explanation of how it should act.
Yes,
although that won't hurt, but you need more.
Yes, because it involves when I see it, it involves my head, my heart, my body, like everything. It's an embodied experience to see it. Like, I think about how I got used to, in a culture that was so busy and so big, I got used to like, keep your head down, don't count on eye contact, just keep moving. It's about getting a lot of people in, getting a lot of people out. And I went and visited this beautiful Episcopalian church. And I was like, it was a reckoning to realize that people were available for eye contact and conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, why did this feel so strange to me? But it was literally living that principle of being with each other and being present, because I'd made in my mind so many excuses for so long. Like, well, there's so many people. It's not about me. Where, you know, there's no time to connect with other people. But, you know, being a mom with staying home with children, it's like you're hungry for those relational connections. And then I'm realizing the community that is so beautiful, the bridges of those relationships will last. And I hope to invest in Hesed bridges and all those places. Those aren't gone. It's just a different building, right? But it's like, I don't even have a frame of reference for a different culture. Like it's an embodied experience to have people that want to stop and have time and to talk and, oh, we've knitted this scarf for the welcome bag. I'm like, it's just a slower pace and it's just so different. And then to see so many people with gray hair, when that is like not a focus in the culture I'm coming out of, I'm like, I just need to be around people that have been there, done that, because my husband and I just hit a point where it's like all the formulas broke. Like, we've memorized all the how to do this and how to that sermons, and they're breaking and we are breaking, and we're hungry for something more, because we just can't seem to apply all the formulas.
Yeah. And I think you kind of just answered your question, Julie, from earlier. What do you look for in a church so that they have this kind of thing? Right. Another thing I would look for is what you said it beautifully. Are the people unhurried? Do they have time to give you their eyes and to share conversation? And are they trying to serve you in some way? Or are they running around like hamsters in a running wheel where they're so tired, where they hear this and then they're off? You know, that unhurried time for relationships. Basically, what you're saying is in that church, relationships are more important than getting stuff done.
Yes. And
that's kind of what you were seeing in that Episcopal church.
Yes. And you're putting a fire in my brain of the tension of how do you always be welcoming? And then there has to be limits to how many people you can have Hesed community with and how, because you can't, when there's such, I think of back to when I was a ministry director for threes, fours, and fives, like we might get 70 kids in and out of there. There's no possible way. Of course, I was just hurrying them in and out because there's 70 of them. Yep. There's limits. And to accept that there's limits is, I think, the tension maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely. We can only, there's a certain number of Hesed relationships we can actually handle because it's just too much. But what can happen is you can create a Hesed network of relationships where, like, maybe if we're going to church, I don't know you, but maybe I know another person who knows you. So I'm attached to this other person. But when I realize that he knows you, all of a sudden, like from the Hesed from 0 to 10, right? Normally you would be like a 1 or 2 that I have never met you at all. You, instead of being a 1 or 2, or maybe more like a 5 or a 6, because I trust my friend who knows you. So you and I start off at a much higher Hesed level, even though we haven't known each other very much. And so as long as we're in that network of Hesed relationships, you know, somehow that needs to solve the problem of the 70 young kids in a preschool Sunday school class. There needs to be this sense of a Hesed network, because one or two leaders just can't do it. But without Hesed, nothing's going to change. You're not going to get any character change in these kids. You're not going to see them loving like Jesus loves. Mm. You have to have this. Part of the problem with churches is that the building of love is an afterthought. So they set things up to get maximum amount of people into a room and hear a message, which is good. We need to hear the message. We prefer having love at the center. We organize everything around love, and then we bring the message in a way that doesn't harm love either, that actually amplifies and helps love. Mm. But what that actually looks like, I don't know. You know, people are doing everything from home churches all the way up to mega churches trying to do this, and we'll see, you know, I think over the next generation, we'll see what works and what doesn't.
That's so true. Only time will tell. There's something in me that always wants like the next right formula.
Right.
And it's not like that. It's not like that. Well, I'm searching for words to express how grateful I am for this book, The Other Half of Church. It's such a source of, God has used it to bring such healing and hope and vision for my family and for, you know, where I want to plug in and put roots in for a community. So thank you so much for all you've done. And thank you for your time this morning. I really appreciate your ministry.
Thank you, Julie. I've really enjoyed our time together.
One last thing. I am so curious to get more info from you. You know, doing the podcast, it's a labor of love. I have to have a place to put my stories because I love sharing them. It's a place of healing for me. And then to get the feedback that I get from people after the podcast blows my heart and mind. I am so grateful that you trust me with your stories. And I'm so grateful that you trust me with your pain and your enthusiasm. So please, please, please don't hesitate to contact me with your feedback. I love to hear from you. And it certainly helps uncover the mystery because sometimes I look at the downloads and I'm like, actually, a friend of mine even said to me recently, she was like, well, yeah, you know, when you're talking, you know your audience. And I was like, whoa, wait. I was like, I actually don't. It's quite mysterious to me. Like, who are these 161 people that downloaded this podcast? Like, who are they? So please, thank you so much for sharing what you have already shared. And please don't hesitate to share more. And of course, if you like the podcast, like it, share it, share a podcast with a friend, share it on Facebook, follow me on Instagram, all the things. So thank you for being connected with me through this podcast. I value your ears.
old soul with a new chance to grow. I can't start to compare. Still a young spirit, an old.